Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today says we are on the cusp of a brand new world with profound ethical and moral issues. Yet the average person understands little of the complexity, the science, the function, and the form of this world. That world is the world of genetics or genomics. Pulitzer Prize winner Siddhartha Mukherjee says we've now entered the fourth phase of genetics, which offers morally complex decision-making on whether to allow, regulate, or forbid our increasing ability to manipulate, create, and write genomes. In Mukherjee's own words, he says, if manipulating genes allows us to change human identities and fates, then the science of genetics can't remain confined to the laboratory. Every human being needs to know and understand this story, for it is ultimately a story of ourselves and our future. His book, which examines the past, present, and increasingly the near future of genetics, is titled The Gene, An Intimate History. It's published by Scribner's. Siddhartha Mukherjee is the author of The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, which won the 2011 Pulitzer Prize. He is a cancer physician and an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Siddhartha Mukherjee, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
While one might expect that this new book is a natural follow-on to your previous book on cancer, given the genetic component of cancer, it's interesting to know that perhaps the real reason for writing this book was very personal. Tell us this personal reason behind The Gene.
Well, this book has been in my brain for a very long time and goes back to a history of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in my family. More than one generation, actually two, potentially even three generations in my family has been affected by mental illness, in particular schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And the fact that it was multi-generational was something that I thought about all my life, all my childhood. You know, like most families, my family had elevated denial to a kind of museum-grade art form. But nonetheless, it was impossible not to know. It was impossible not to think about the genetic component of all of this. And so The Gene begins as an exploration of family, exploration of what happens when you know in your own family that something genetic might be lurking and why that didn't affect all of us, why were only some of us affected, why were only some cousins and some uncles affected. And so, in a sense, I had thought about this book long before I had thought about the book on cancer. Cancer came later in my life as an oncologist, but the familial component was earlier.
And as you were growing up, I'm sure the definitive link hadn't been made at that particular point that heredity plays a role, or had it? I don't know.
Well, there was absolutely suggestions, even in the 1950s and 1960s, that for schizophrenia, at least, that there was a hereditary component. We knew this from studies on twins, identical twins. You know, when one twin was affected, the chance that the other twin would be affected was vastly greater than sort of the baseline, 10 times greater than the baseline. So there was clearly a genetic component. But it was clearly more than a genetic component, because it was also clear that, again, from the studies done in the 1960s, 70s, and 1980s, that it wasn't 100%. You know, if one twin, identical twin, was affected, the other twin was not affected 100% of the time. So it was one of these cases in which, obviously, it was a combination of genes plus chance plus environment plus some kind of trigger, all of these coming together. That was one thing that was clear. And the second thing that was clear, also again by the 1980s, very, very important studies done, is that for schizophrenia at least, and also potentially for bipolar disorder, that there was not one gene. There was not a single, you know, for most cases, it wasn't a gene for schizophrenia or a gene for bipolar disorder, but in fact there were many genes. And they had to operate somehow together in order to precipitate these often devastating mental illnesses. So that was what was known, but the details were not known, and to some extent you could say they still are not known fully.
Yeah. In the story, you weave your personal story of your family along with lots of research that you do in telling the story of the gene, and it seems like your family has wrestled with this notion of heredity playing a role in their family members' illnesses. And I think about it, a lot of families where we're seeing that illnesses have a hereditary, like autoimmune diseases, this is something families don't really consider too much.
This is an incredible, you know, the gene is not the story, or the book is not a story about one family.
Yeah.
It happens to be my family. it's a story about all families. You know, it's about, you know, more and more every family is discovering in their history, in its history, some component of an illness which is much like this, you know, skipping generations, many genes involved, unpredictable, and yet, you know, crossing several generations and manifesting itself in very different ways in very different people. So this is your story, this is my story. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to make sure that this is a story that resonated with everyone else. This is not something for, you know, to put away in the back closet and hide, but something to confront. This is going to become part of our future. And if you want to learn about our own futures, if you want to learn about our own, how we deal with this in the future, how we deal with mental illness in the future, we have to get the vocabulary. What do genes do? How do they operate? Is it one gene? Is it many genes? How does all this come together? How, what kind of triggers are involved? So all of this impetus is to make the point that this is a much, much more common story. It's not something to stuff away in the laboratory and forget about it. It's something to think about in our daily lives.
In the course of telling the story of the gene, you begin with some of the first big discoveries, obviously Darwin's work, but you begin really with the first big discovery in uncovering the secrets of gene, and that was Mendel and his experiments with peas and his hereditary paper. And what really amazed me about this is that, you know, we all know about Mendel and his work on heredity, but that paper sat gathering dust for 40 years.
Longer than 40 years. And you know, Mendel's an amazing character, and the book begins with Mendel for that reason. Actually, I spent time in Mendel's monastery myself. You know, you can't live there, but certainly I spent time wandering around, looking around, trying to figure out how this person, this monk, this friar, could even be. How did this man, barely trained in the sciences, he was not a full-time scientist, although he had certainly had scientific training, could stumble on, you know, the seminal discovery of the 20th century, of 20th century and 21st century biology, the idea that information is carried in this kind of discrete form across generations. He's an amazing character, mysterious character, and as you point out, partly because he was sort of outside the canonical scientific world, he was basically, that paper was ignored. The paper that founded biology, modern biology, would sit basically in an obscure journal gathering dust before it was rediscovered about 40 years later.
As scientists were doing their own work and sort of replicating his work, pretty much, wasn't it?
And again, not until, I mean, the question, the central question that drives this book that should invite curiosity in everyone is, why do we look like our parents? Or why don't we look like our parents? Why do diseases cross through families? Or why don't diseases cross through families? What is normalcy or what is abnormalcy? I mean, these kinds of questions, we've been asking this question since the birth of history, since the birth of our, you know, as far as we can remember. And yet it was this relatively isolated monk working in a relatively isolated, not even in a laboratory, but in a garden in what is now the Czech Republic, in a tiny monastery garden, who figured out that when we transmit information, when cells transmit information through other cells, or when humans transmit information through other humans, we do so in this kind of discrete form. I mean, I don't know if you knew this, but Mendel didn't even coin the word gene. He didn't even know the word gene. All he understood, or I shouldn't say all, but what he really understood is that this information is carried in this particular form, like an atom or like a blob of information. It doesn't get diluted, it doesn't get cut up or changed, but it gets, you know, it gets transmitted like this. What's amazing about all of this, I mean, this is why what I found interesting in the book, what's amazing about this is that it's quite counterintuitive. You know, we think of the colors of human eyes and we say, well, it must all be because, you know, information gets mixed and matched and diluted like paint. And, you know, a person with, if you have a father with blue eyes and a mother with dark, you know, green eyes, then the child has an eye which is somehow mixed paint together, you know, somewhere between dark green and blue. And that's what you might think is true. That's what you might observe. In the whole natural world, that's what it seems to be. But what's really happening, and this is what Mendel discovered, is that particles of information are being transmitted. There's a particle of information that's being transmitted undiluted. Several different particles of information are being transmitted that govern the color of eyes. And ultimately, the color of eye that you get is the result of sort of pixels, much as, you know, you could look at your computer screen and think that it's all continuous. But if you look really close, they're little pixels. And that's how heredity works. That's how genes work. They're pixels of information.
Yeah, and of course, some will have the bright blue eyes of the father, some will have a mix, and some will have the green eyes of the mother.
And again, no one was able to solve even that problem until Mendel pointed, he didn't solve the problem either, but he pointed to the essential solution, which is that information doesn't get broken up or it doesn't get diluted out like paint. It gets carried forward like pixels or like particles.
Now, the question I had about it was, you know, humans had been breeding farm animals for selective traits for generations, maybe millennia. Why was the idea of this discrete pieces of information coming from a parent to offspring not totally intuitive?
Well, again, if you look at farm animals, you can seem to get the idea that somehow things blend together, that the child
Yes.
or the animal that you get is a kind of wearing blender. It mixes together the physical traits of the father and the mother. And, you know, if you have a cow with very long horns and a cow with very short horns, you get a cow with intermediate size horns, right? And that's how selective breeding occurs. But if you were to look at in terms of genes, what's happening is that there are many genes that specify horn shape or size. And a certain combination of genes, each individual, each undiluted, a certain combination of genes creates the ultimate feature. The best analogy that I can think of is the following. Think of five sheets of transparent paper, each with a different color. You know, one carries the color blue, the other is red, the other is green, the other is purple, etc. Now, if you overlap these five little individual sheets, you can create virtually every color in the spectrum, in the overlap. And yet, here's what's important, is that when you do so, the five individual sheets of paper remain undiluted. They remain themselves. It's just that the overlap of these five individual pieces is producing the distinct quality of every single feature. That's what's counterintuitive about genes, and that's what's powerful about genes. It's counterintuitive because you say to yourself, you know, the physical world, you know, this, you're making cows that are bigger or smaller or can, you know, more muscular or less muscular, etc. And it feels as if you're blending everything together. Well, what's amazing about genes, of course, is that the essence of the information remains the same, and it doesn't get diluted, it doesn't get changed.
Now, from those first experiments that Mendel did, you take us through the whole understanding of the gene. You mentioned, you know, it was interesting that Mendel called them units, and how we wound up with the term gene. Because a gene was more of an abstract idea when the word was invented rather than something we could actually know anything about, its structure, where it was, how it existed, whether it was chemical or biological, or we didn't know virtually anything about the gene at the time the word was coined.
Basically, no one knew anything about genes when the word was coined. The word was coined to carry the information about that abstraction, to carry information about what it, you know, what that abstraction meant and how one could imagine that abstraction. That was all. And so the word was coined to try to give a sense that there must be something that's being carried across generations, some information, some particle of information that's being carried across generations. And in fact, you know, as I pointed out in the book, they try to call it gen, but the word gene is what we're stuck with.
I was really struck by something you wrote because the next section of the book deals with the eugenics movement. And I was struck by something you wrote. Said, you know, in a little over 60 years from Mendel's experiments, we went from the gene being an abstract concept in a botanical experiment to an incredibly powerful instrument of social control, with whole classes of people being deemed inferior. Why was this the first leap we made once we began to understand something about genetics?
The idea that heredity could be somehow twisted and used to make ourselves better, make human beings, the human race better, was an old idea and is an old idea. Of course, people have toyed with it. As I point out, people have toyed with it for the time of Plato, and even long before that. But all of a sudden, the fact that you know, there was a biological basis to all of this created a new vocabulary, created a new language. And what I show in the book is, I mean, I was myself surprised with it, about it, which is that there's a progression. There's a kind of dark progression from the moment in which you know, genes are discovered as an abstract entity. No one knows what a gene is. No one knows what a gene is chemically, biologically. And yet there's a progression that happens between using genes to make people better. So Francis Galton, who, I mean, you know, the stories are so fascinating because Galton was, of course, Charles Darwin's cousin. So Darwin's cousin comes up with the idea of eugenics and says that, you know, maybe we should be breeding people to make people better and have smarter, in his words, smarter, more vigorous, taller, in his conception, more beautiful humans by breeding, selective breeding of people, because they will get better and better genes, just like you can do with farm animals. This is in the 1910s, 1920s. Galton's ideas are considered highly progressive. They are considered, you know, people think that this is the right thing to do. And then that idea metastasizes to the United States, where all of a sudden, from selective breeding, we go to selective sterilization. And I tell the story of Carrie Buck, one of the first women to be sterilized because she was thought to have a gene for mental illness in her genetic makeup. And by Supreme Court mandate, she was sterilized so that she wouldn't propagate the genes for mental illness. She was considered an imbecile. And Oliver Wendell Holmes famously wrote, "Three generations of imbeciles is enough," and thereby ordered the court-mandated sterilization of Carrie Buck. And then it metastasizes yet again to Nazi Germany, where it becomes, you know, this is the familiar eugenics. This is, of course, what we hear about, which is, you know, now from sterilization, we move on to extermination. So selective breeding to selective sterilization to selective extermination, you know, the road to that hell is paved with seemingly progressive intentions each time. You know, why don't we make ourselves a little bit better? Why don't we make our race a little bit better? That's a theme that I come back to over and over again in this book.
My guest today is Siddhartha Mukherjee, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Emperor of All Maladies, a cancer physician and professor of medicine at Columbia University. His new book is titled The Gene, An Intimate History. It's published by Scribner. Well, if I can jump ahead a little bit in the book, in talking about the Human Genome Project, James Watson, the man with Watson and Crick who developed the model of DNA, you have a quote by him saying, "What we're doing, we're making ourselves a little better suited to survival, just a little better." That whole idea is still with us today.
I mean, also, you know, let me just remind ourselves that there are powerful things about genes that are useful and important. You know, genes are the way we understand many terrifying human illnesses. Genes are the way we understand, you know, we're trying to use gene therapy to cure cystic fibrosis, for instance. We're trying to use gene therapy right now to cure terrible diseases of the eye, you know, terrible bone marrow diseases. If we didn't understand how genetics worked, we wouldn't understand how maybe schizophrenia works or how sickle cell anemia causes its disease.
Or a lot of autoimmune diseases.
Or a lot of autoimmune diseases. And so there's certainly, it's very much an example of technology that is simultaneously powerful but also potentially dangerous. And I think Jim Watson captures that idea, saying, yes, we're trying to use genes to make ourselves better. And the question is, you know, can we avoid the temptation of using genes to manipulate them for doing things that would, you know, tamper with nature?
What would you say our track record is at this particular point, giving things like Dolly the sheep and using recombinant DNA and gene therapy experiments that we did, say, 20 years ago?
Well, the track record, I think, fairly speaking, keeps improving. I think we have become safer. We are learning to become safer. It's an ongoing process. You know, there's never a solution because it's always changing, and the track is changing, and so the track record is changing. You know, I remind ourselves of the horrific tragedy of one of the first gene therapy experiments where the child, Jesse Gelsinger, died, mainly because we didn't know enough about the technology, and the technology was launched in a manner that was not appropriately safe-kept. Now we have more and more gene therapy trials. Many of them have been successful. But it means continuous surveillance. We need continuous surveillance to figure out what we're doing, whether it's safe, how safe is it, and to make sure that safety keeps getting surveyed over and over again. even recombinant DNA, you know, the idea that you can, I mean, I talk about this in the book, what an astonishing idea that you can take a gene from a human being, a gene from a chimpanzee, and stitch them together, put them in a bacterial cell, and that gene will, you know, behave as if it's one continuous piece of information. That idea is simultaneously, again, very powerful. It allows us to understand complicated human diseases, but also very dangerous because it allows us to, for instance, interfere with the human biosphere. So yet another example where we see that we need to know the vocabulary, and that's why partly I wrote the book. If we want to participate in this conversation, we need to know the vocabulary of what genes are, what they do, how they do it, and what the future holds for us.
One of the things I did enjoy about the book was the contributions of people that have become somewhat lost to history. Like in telling the story of Watson and Crick developing the model of DNA, tell us about the contributions of Rosalind Franklin, who was integral to helping Watson and Crick understand this double helix design of DNA through her own work. There was also an early person in sort of developing the idea that genes and genetic material was a chemical material from a horribly shy scientist named Frederick Griffith, who sort of buried the lead in his paper that was as obscure as any in the world.
Well, Rosalind Franklin was an amazing scientist, a pioneer, a woman working in crystallography when there were very few women in working in that field. Dorothy Hodgkins comes to mind, but she was working on the structure of DNA, and she was taking photographs. She was using X-ray crystallography, a novel, powerful technique. And Rosalind Franklin was one of the first people who produced the most beautiful, what has been called the most beautiful picture of DNA, in which she saw essentially what would look to you and me like a shadow, a cross shadow, an X, and yet provided definitive proof that the double helix that we know as the double helix was in fact the double helix. She worked, she had a hard time. Often she was in London, but she had to leave her job and take up another job elsewhere. But Rosalind Franklin was a brilliant character and really had been neglected by history. Her role had been neglected by history. Although, to be fair, both Watson and Crick were themselves very frank about giving her credit in the later part of their lives.
Yeah. Well, if we can move on just for a moment to talk a little bit about the Human Genome Project. There's a whole section of the book on how that took place, the competition between the government effort and the private industry effort. But when we look back at the Human Genome Project, say 50 years from now, how important will we regard this event?
We will regard the Human Genome Project as one of the landmark moments in our history. We will know it as one of the landmark moments in history because, I mean, it is a little bit like landing on the moon. And, there's been, as you may know, a kind of rumbling in the press. Oh, you know, what did the Human Genome Project get us? Well, the most important thing, of course, is that it got us the capacity, it got us the template. It got us, it showed us what the normal roadmap of the human genome looks like. As a cancer biologist, as a cancer scientist, I use the human genome every day. I might find a sequence that's different in a cancer patient. Where do I look for, where do I find what the normal template is in the Human Genome Project? So it's obviously that project is still ongoing. How to understand the human genome is still ongoing. But it is an incredibly important thing, and do not believe the rumblings that it was ultimately not too much use. It's absolutely not true. We use the human genome every day. Our understanding of the human genome is becoming enriched every day. And here's what's most important. You and I need to understand why that's the case. We need to understand the vocabulary, because as we now begin to tamper with genomes, we'll need to have a conversation, a large public conversation, about what is allowed, what's not allowed, what's good, what's not good, what's normal, what's not normal. And if you don't have the vocabulary, if you don't know the words, if you don't know the terms, if you don't know how genes work, you will miss out that conversation, and you shouldn't miss out that conversation. None of us should.
Is that really the takeaway from the book, is that we as lay people who don't know a lot of this terminology, we only have a sort of innate sense of what can benefit mankind and what can be detrimental. We need to be better educated in order to help.
The takeaway from the book is that this is a vast story, and this is a story that's essential to being a human being. We need to know how we are created, what the parameters are, how genes affect our bodies and ourselves, our identities, our temperaments, our personalities, the extent to which chance plays a role, the extent to which nurture or the environment plays a role. We need to understand this, and only after we understand this can we have a real conversation about who we are. So it's not just the vocabulary that I'm after. What I'm really interested in is, look, we're on the eve of changing the human genome. We have invented technologies that allow us to interfere with the human genome. Those technologies are about 5 or 6 years old, and there's a vast debate going on right now about the extent to which we're allowed to interfere or change the human genome and what that would do, or other animal genomes. That's a conversation that cannot happen in a medical boardroom, that cannot happen in a laboratory room. It cannot happen in isolation. It has to happen across the world, across people. It's as fundamental a conversation as, you know, what happens politically tomorrow or what happens to you tomorrow. It's a conversation about, you know, what does it mean to be you? To what extent is, I don't know, I'm just pulling out questions, to what extent is sexual orientation a genetic phenomenon? To what extent is personality or temperament dictated by genes versus environment? Why are we having these arguments now? Because the moment is now that we've figured out how to operate on genes and how to change genes.
And very quickly, you write that this is not a discussion that will happen, say, in a decade or 5 to 10 or 15 years. You actually write in the book, you said you were openly wondered whether by the time the book went to press, we would see our first post-genomic human.
And I think that, you know, the chances, as I said, in China, they already tried to make genetic interventions on human embryos, directed genetic interventions on human embryos by the time the book was written. After the book was written, you know, I didn't even know this, there was a secret meeting at Harvard University trying to ask the question, can you chemically synthesize the human genome and thereby write the entire human genome? So these are not things that are happening in the abstract. They're happening in real time. They're happening now. And that's all the more reason we need to read a book about genes now.
All right. Siddhartha, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. He's an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and a cancer physician. His new book is titled The Gene, An Intimate History. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.